disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest with my help.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128-bit war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs for every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't been turned.
Welcome to This Is America, May 28th, 2021. On today's episode, first we speak with a resident of the Norfolk Mobile Home Park in Kentucky about how residents there have been fighting the mass eviction of a trailer park to make way for a strip mall, a move that will displace dozens of families and individuals and enrich one of the most successful businessmen in Kentucky, who will rake in massive amounts of corporate welfare to complete development of this project. We then switch to a recording from a recent May Day event featuring speakers from It's Going Down, Sima Lee, and Clee Benally, who discussed the past year since the start of the George Floyd Rebellion and the path ahead in the changing terrain. All this and more, but first, let's get to the news. Marches, rallies, and letter-writing events to prisoners marked the 1 year since the start of the George Floyd uprising in so-called Minneapolis. 300 marched in downtown Portland, clashing with police and setting off fireworks, while in Minneapolis, a large gathering was held at George Floyd Square. Over the last several weeks, mass demonstrations have continued in solidarity with Palestinians in the occupied territories, resulting in pressuring Israel to end bombardments, which have led to the deaths of over 200 Palestinians, an aggressive campaign of ethnic cleansing. Protests in New York and Montreal have led to clashes with police and pro-Zionist forces in the streets, and in Chicago, the international headquarters of Boeing were blockaded for their role in the selling of weapons to Israel. Under the banner of Abolition May, abolitionist groups across the so-called U.S. have been organizing actions and events throughout the month of May to demand police off college campuses. Actions have ranged from banner drops, marches through campus, teach-ins and educational events, and coffee not cop outreach tables. Protests continue in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, against the police murder of Andrew Brown Jr. Officials have officially ruled that the shooting was, quote, justified, while Brown's family and community members contend he was ambushed and riddled with bullets by police. This week, a white driver was arrested for driving into a crowd of protesters, hitting two African-American women with their car. Protests and marches continue daily. For more in-depth look at the demonstrations, check out our recent interview on the It's Going Down podcast. In Los Angeles, the LAPD issued a citywide tactical alert before opening fire with projectiles in a large outdoor punk rock concert, which led to concertgoers throwing rocks, blocking streets, and firing off fireworks. In Philadelphia, hundreds took to the streets to mark the anniversary of the police bombing of the eco-radical group MOVE in 1985. From one report, surviving members of the MOVE family walked with hundreds of supporters through West Philadelphia Thursday night to commemorate the 36th anniversary of the day city leaders dropped explosives on their compound. A subsequent fire allowed to burn to the point where it turned more than 60 houses to ash, killed 11 people, including 5 children. Just hours before, Pam Africa and Mike Africa Jr. began their remembrance of lost comrades by describing the two-day assault. Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney announced the resignation of the city's top health official from his handling remains of victims of the bombing. Over 50 people have been arrested at the Ferry Creek Tree Sit blockade in so-called British Columbia since the police began enforcing an injunction on the land in an attempt to stop resistance to logging in some of the last remaining old-growth forest. Resistance to the Line 3 pipeline continues. Be sure to check out the website at Rising Tide North America for ongoing updates. Recently, a large lockdown has stalled construction of the site, and water protectors have also organized a demonstration outside the home of a bank executive helping to fund the project. Trial has begun for several of the tiny house warriors in so-called Canada who are fighting the Trans Mountain Pipeline, and the Six Nations land reclamation at 1492 Land Back Lane continues. From a report on social media, members of the Six Nations of the Grand River have built cabins and other structures on the site, which is right beside the Six Nations territory, and have been living there for the past 9 months. The purpose of the occupation is to halt construction of a housing project by Foxgate Developments. While blockades have come down since October, people have been preparing for a summer of get-togethers, concerts, and lacrosse games on the land. in Mohawk territory in so-called Quebec, in the same area where the Oka Crisis in 1990 kicked off with fierce resistance, Native people continued to resist development of land for the tourism industry. Recently, a car caravan was organized to support ongoing land defense efforts. Members of the Industrial Workers of the World, or the IWW, have been very busy working to unionize Moe's Books in Berkeley, California, charter school workers in Richmond, California, and also the staff of the Socialist Rifle Association, the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, and also Voodoo Donuts in Portland, Oregon. Also in Berkeley, marches and protests have been ongoing, fighting back against proposed evictions by UC Berkeley of housing in the Autonomous People's Park. And now for some upcoming events. On June 5th, at the Beaverton City Library, there is a Zine Fest and Mutual Aid Fair in Beaverton, Oregon. Also on June 5th, there's an Abolition Assembly and Barbecue in Richmond, Virginia. On June 11th, the International Day of Solidarity with Marius Mason and other long-term anarchist prisoners. So far, Philadelphia is organizing a barbecue and a movie fundraiser. In Detroit, Michigan, there is a planned noise demonstration. From June 12th through the 13th, there is a Skillshare convergence in so-called Philadelphia featuring workshops, discussions, and tabling. From June 26th through July 1st, there is an Earth First Summer gathering happening in so-called Minnesota. And finally, on August 21st through September 9th, there is a call for abolitionist actions in support of prisoner struggles. For more information on all these events, see our show notes. And if you value What's Going Down as a revolutionary autonomous media resource in times of crisis and you have the means, please go to itsgoingdown.org/shop. Again, that's itsgoingdown.org/shop and sign up to become a monthly supporter or give us a one-time donation on the site or through Bitcoin. You can also follow our RSS feed, listen to us on the radio, tell a friend about It's Going Down, and follow us on various social media platforms. And remember, It's Going Down is part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. So if you like this show, there's probably lots more waiting for you on the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network website. That's going to do it for us right now. As always, enjoy the interviews and the discussions, and we will see you soon.
Capitalism is failing. What started as a crisis of the finance system has spilled over into social upheavals, civil wars, as in Syria and Ukraine, yeah, and upset the geopolitical balance.
Look. Everybody got a whole lot of questions, not a whole lot of answers, just a whole lot of guessing. If you see me doing dirt, don't give me no lecture. I was born from the earth, birthed under pressure.
What you know about acting up and showing now?
To get all the attention, we would go without. A pessimist on the precipice of depression. All my partners got PTSD and carry loaded weapons. And they don't see no doctors, but they got all the prescriptions. And they don't ever pop them, they just trying to run a business. They just trying to feed their children, they just trying to stay alive. Hey, fuck you if you judging, what would you do to survive? Rest in peace to Sharon, I know the words will live on. They say the word is your bond. I put that on the Quran, the Bible, or anything that you want. Raising my arm, I swear it all to every God, government fraud. I'm that guy that burned the flag on your lawn. Fuck it, ACAB baby, I'm down with getting some justice. If we crabs in a bucket, then they pigs in a blanket. Make that police station smell like bacon.
Capitalism is a disease. If you ain't got money, then you ain't gon' eat. They tell us to roll up our sleeves, put in that work, get the money and leave. Meanwhile the rich getting richer while we sitting bigger. Triggers and put every one of them down on their knees.
Shorty get it poppin', shorty get it poppin'. I ain't really feel like I'm running out of options. Fuck how you feel, fuck your soul and your conscience. I am beyond it, I'm about nonsense. Put it all out in the open. We know about the money in the ocean. I don't give a fuck about your taxes. I just wanna see you get your ass kicked with that 10-on-1, cause I don't remember fair fights where I'm from. Put that on your dead homie, don't ever get it twisted. You can go insane in this psychopathic business. When it blows up, eruption. Really no need for discussion. I don't give a fuck about your taxes when we seize the means of production.
Capitalism is a disease. If you ain't got money, then you ain't gon' tell us to roll up our sleeves, put in that work, get the money and leave. Meanwhile the rich get richer while we
said Vicar, do as they please. I say we roll up with triggers,
yeah.
Put everyone down on their knees.
If all we got is us, but all I see is enemies. And who am I to trust when all my friends don't remember me? Cause they fucked up off them drugs that we used to sell. Might as well turn the gun around and use it on ourselves. Addiction is a sickness, man-made epidemic. Quarantine the disease by locking us in a prison. Criminal or victim, can you tell me what's the difference? When the dealer is a dealer just so he can get his fix, and the person that he sold to sold to him and vice versa. A constant circle fueled by fiends, cops and murders. Rocks, Glocks and burners. You buying or you serving? Is you dreaming with King or you busting with Nat Turner? What's the point of speaking up? Ain't nobody trying to listen till we start tearing shit up. And everyone got an opinion. Fuck 'em. You don't be where I be. You ain't seen what I seen, but you bleed like I bleed. So fuck you. Ain't no need for discussion. When you preaching to the choir, the streets ain't hearing nothing. Organized religion, just another form of pimping. All I see is division. Is you Muslim or you Christian? I ain't saying don't believe, I'm just saying pay attention. Most of these preachers is more crooked than politicians. Money hungry, feeding off the people for a pension. You ain't getting nothing from me. If you want it, come get it, bitch.
Capitalism is a disease. If you ain't got money, then you ain't gon' eat. They tell us to roll up our sleeves, put in that work, get the money and leave. Meanwhile, the rich getting richer while we sitting bicker and do as they please. I say we roll up with triggers and put every one of them down on their knees.
We can and we should do better than capitalism. We should reorganize society, because that will be a better way to deal with all those problems than dealing with them individually, as if you could solve homelessness or solve inequality by a quick fix, by a marginal adjustment. No, the problems are systemic.
Okay, well, we're located right off of I-64, and it meets Highway 32. I think it's exit 137, actually. And apparently, it's a good place to put a strip mall. A couple years ago, the city officials who have control over taxes decided to raise the property owners' taxes to $2 million. So she received $100 a month from us for lot rent. And there's, I think, approximately 72 trailers up here. So she raised our lot rent to $125. Okay, obviously, that's not going to make up $2 million. So then I'm not sure when actually the proceedings started between her and a land developer. According to her, it was recently. According to him, it was 2 years ago.
Just let me cut in for people that are listening. If you haven't lived in a trailer park or you don't have friends, basically you own your mobile home or you pay a mortgage like a house.
Right.
But you have to pay the landlord essentially of the park or the company usually a space rent fee. So it's kind of like the worst of both worlds of like owning a home and then also renting, because you like own the structure, but the land itself it's on, you have to pay the landlord. And a lot of places people get screwed because they'll just jack up the price for the space rent by hundreds of dollars, like you all. Sounds like happened to you.
Yeah, which ours only went up $25, but obviously the landowner cannot make up $2 million worth of taxes just off of that. But I would say in the fall, last fall, probably maybe August, September, we started hearing rumors that the property had been sold. So several of us, at the same time when we were all together, would call different people trying to get information. Like we called the property manager, we called people at the city, different places like that, asking them, is this in the works? Everybody acted like they didn't know what we were talking about. And then one day we found out there was actually a city council meeting that was airing on Facebook, where they had had a meeting talking about the Hope Project, although none of us had heard about it. I didn't know anything about it until somebody goes, look, here it's on Facebook. So then that Hope City Council meeting is actually on Facebook, and city officials claimed that they did everything they could to let everybody know about the meeting coming up, that it was like posted maybe on social media and in the newspaper, different things like that. If it was ever posted, I didn't see it. I didn't hear anything about it, because I promise you I would have been at that meeting.
They sold the land before, like a long time ago, basically, you're saying?
Actually, the land hasn't actually sold to the property developer. It's contingent on all of us being gone. All the people being gone. And then the property developer, I guess, will take control of the land.
But basically, they started the wheels of this long, long time ago, basically, and didn't tell any of you.
Right. Okay. So the property owner says she just heard about it a few days before the deal, and I'm doing my air quotes, the deal happened. But Patrick Madden, the land developer, stated on actual like ABC News that this project has been in the works for 2 years.
And when did you all hear about that, you know, your homes would be threatened?
Our actual legitimate legal information came on March the 6th in a letter that I don't even know what the letter says. I didn't open it because I knew what it meant. So when we basically had 45 days to get our stuff and get out. And this is in a college town where, first of all, there is no affordable housing, but whenever actual school, actual classes are going on, there is nowhere to rent, buy, whatever. And what is available is probably from $600-$700 to $1,000.
And that's because the students are in town and it's more expensive.
Therefore, people who actually live in a home they own being forced to go out and pay rent for $1,000 a month.
And what's the people that live in the mobile home community, are they a lot of people, are they like seniors? Are they people on a fixed income?
It's all different. It's all kinds of people. There are young people just starting out. There are middle aged people and there are seniors. It's just a whole variety of people, just regular working class people of all ages.
Right. Well, I think a lot of people listening to this would ask, how is it legal that someone basically has the land under them sold and then they get a letter in the mail saying you've got to move within 45 days? Because, I mean, I think the other thing that people have to realize is that the term mobile home is kind of deceptive. It's really expensive to actually physically, if you want to take a manufactured home and physically move it, it could take thousands of dollars. And of course, you've also got to like find somewhere to put that home, which is a whole process in itself.
About, I think it's maybe, I'm not sure about the date, so I better not say that. But around the same time that the taxes were increased on the property owner here, there was a rule made inside the city limits that no mobile homes could come in past 1995, which a lot of these homes up here are way older than that. So then you have to look, okay, so then a lot of other mobile home parks did the same thing. They made their rules that they would only accept homes like one of them is 2,000. The other, like 2,000 is about it. If your home is older than that, no one will accept it.
Right. Which a lot of times bars people that, you know, bought their homes a long time ago or they bought a cheaper home.
Right. Which is exactly the position I'm in. Mine's old, like from the 80s. So none of the mobile home parks in this local area would take it. So I'm just being forced to move to someplace where somebody will take one that's old.
You're just expected to like sell your home within 45 days? Is that what people are trying to do?
Either sell it. Some people have sold. Some people have just already moved. And then there are people whose homes cannot be moved. They're so old, and it's really water stands up here a lot. So a lot of people's homes, like actually the tongue that you would use to move a trailer, is rusted. So that there are several people here who have just had to walk off and leave it. Just walk off and leave your home.
If they were actually able to displace everybody, what would they build there? The shopping center or whatever, the strip mall?
Generally, it's a strip mall. The land developer actually owns a huge mall area in a town down the road from us. And I guess it's supposed to be like a little mini version of that, with just like restaurants, gas stations, I guess.
So like, stuff that's everywhere else, basically, that right. They could build anywhere.
The last thing this area needs, first of all, is another gas station and more traffic.
Yeah.
If there's no way anybody could have done some kind of study to see what the impact of more traffic could have done on this area and thought this was going to be a good idea.
What has been the response from, the local city government to this? Have they said anything at all or done anything?
They say it was a private sale. They have nothing to do with it. And if you need help, they can give you a list of charitable organizations that can help you out.
Has there been anybody that just said, like, we're just going to physically stay here and they're, you know, we're just going to basically stay in our homes and we'll just basically stay to the last stand? Or
there are people who are actually in positions because of different circumstances in their lives that are staying until all of their other things can get worked out. But at this point, I'm not sure anybody's just like, okay, go ahead, chain me to a tree, I'm staying.
Because I guess ultimately they would just call the police in. Is that the...
That's been the threat, that the sheriff will show up and give you an eviction notice. And there have been other threats, like they're just going to come in, bulldoze them over. That's just one of many of the threats that we've all heard. It's just a threat that you're just going to lose your home completely, or the threat that you're going to end up in jail over it. And some of us are still here because of just different things that are keeping us from moving.
So is there anything left in the works in terms of just people trying to fight back to keep their homes, or is it, do you feel like it's a done deal at this point?
Well, we have things that we are still working on. Like I said, with Ben Carter, who's looking at the TIF to see if anything was violated there. Which, you know, that's pretty much it. That's basically all we can do right now is to see if anything was done there. And just asking for all the people involved, the city, the landowner, the land developer, to give more time and compensation. And each one of them says it's not their responsibility to do any of those.
Has there been an attempt to put more pressure on these people, on the developer, to do that?
Well, we've put pressure on him through negative publicity.
Yeah.
Like, you know, with our actions that we do and all of those things, it's gained a lot of negative attention on him. Somebody hung signs up at Keeneland during Derby Week about Patrick Manning is making people homeless, different things like that. And his response is still the same. It's not his yet. This isn't his property yet. He doesn't take over until we are all gone. But then he also made a statement that said, if the city of Moorhead, Kentucky does not want a shopping center, we are not going to force it on them. To just do this to people, and everybody wants to turn a blind eye to it because nobody wants to make the city mad, the city officials mad.
Yeah.
You know, different stuff that's involved with that. And I'm sure everybody in large towns and small towns everywhere understand that. But just make yourself aware that this could be you next.
Palestine's been occupied for decades, but a home for centuries. This land is generations of my family's memories. To plant, grow, and nurture the symbol of peace. The olive trees guaranteed that our people could eat. Living with limitations, pushed down by the occupation. Wanna see the pain? Take a look at the people's faces. Imagine being kicked out of the only house you ever known. We're praying for our souls while they're praying on our homes. It's not easy to put this into words. Looking at my baby sister, is this something she deserves? Growing up in a world where she's not treated the same. Denied the right to live free because of where she came. They wanna occupy this land. Won't let them occupy my mind. I stay occupied aside as I write about my life. Because my only mission is to make people listen. This one's for Shashara, hoping it can make a difference. Cause the same thing happened in 48. My grandparents got evicted and forced to move away to the refugee camp in Gaza. No, nothing has changed. They can never return, so that's where I am today. Getting calls from cousins to see if I am alive. This year is not fireworks that are lighting the sky. We're trying to celebrate an Eid and keep the faith. I guess you could say it's how memories are made. Palestine.
Peace to everyone. Greetings. Just to introduce myself after that great introduction, I'm Sima Lee, originally from Norfolk, Virginia. I've been organizing in Virginia, Washington, D.C. for several years, as well as now here in Baltimore, Maryland. I'm the founder of the Maroon Movement, Food Clothing Resistance Collective. I'm also a conscious citizen of the Republic of New Africa. I'm in several New African formations, such as Malcolm X Grassroots Movement and New African Liberation Collective, which is headed by Kwame Shakur and Shaka Shakur, who are both incarcerated by the empire. I'm also a part of Ujima People's Progress Party here in Baltimore, and aligned with a lot of other organizations in solidarity. Being involved with so many different groups, maintaining a podcast, Marooncast, also making music. You have a lot of conversations with people. We focus heavily on mutual aid at our organization, Maroon Movement. When you're doing mutual aid, you're spreading information, you're receiving information, you're having real-time conversations about the realities that everyone is dealing with. And of course, while dealing with the pandemic, it was even more intense in light of all of the racial strife, intentions, murders, arrests. It's been one hell of a, I say a year from March to March or April to April. It's been one hell of a year, and it's caused a lot of us to reflect. And so this is a timely topic that we have. I probably won't take 10 minutes, but just to share some of the reflections that I've been having with myself and other, you know, comrades and OGs and grandmothers, and, you know, everybody has an opinion on where we're going. For myself, all of the groups that I am involved with are focusing on building infrastructure, building coalitions, alliances, within our communities, outside of our communities, local, regional, national, and international. Because if we've really been observing what's been going on for this span of year and the reaction that we've had to it as a mass group, separate groups, but a mass movement is out there, right? We can feel something. There's a connection. You know, we see people doing mutual aid everywhere. People are taking to the streets immediately when someone is harmed. People are putting their bodies on the line, when people are being harmed by the police or mediating and so forth. We see a movement coming. The infrastructure needs to be there, though. We're coming together for mutual aid, cooperative, collective things. Not everyone is on that page. A lot of people are coming to mobilizations and then you never see them again. You never hear from them again. There is no follow up. You know, there is no, it's very hard to go up against people who, I mean, many people don't want to admit it, but the right wing has been organizing their asses off. We have been reactive to it, not reactionary, but reactive. We're reacting to things that are going on from the state. We're reacting to things that are going on from right-wing citizens. But if we were proactive, we would already have our community watches and our mediators and our harm reduction teams and you know, making small mutual aid, massive mutual aid networks, connecting farms, connecting, you know, food pantries. We would already know, we would already have our own emergency services, our own comms and communication. I don't mean just for one organization or just one hood or just one whatever. I mean, it would be interconnected. And this is where we have to go. This is where we need to be able to really handle something like what happened in Texas and what happened in Mississippi and what's been happening in Flint and DC and Baltimore and everywhere else, you know, amongst the Diné, you know, we have no water often, no clean water, as well as the comrades who are incarcerated. I've been speaking heavily, with comrades who are incarcerated because we need their input. Very much so. Brother Kwame Shakur and Brother Shaka Shakur have been sharing their experiences in of subhuman food, not actually boxes marked with food not fit for human consumption. If you've heard of meat rock or this loaf, you know, that they feed people in prison in addition to brown water, toxic conditions, in addition to torture, in addition to being cramped together 23 hours a day in small cells and only let out for maybe an hour. A lot of these comrades have a lot to say about what we're doing on the ground and really useful suggestions. And I've been listening and I've been making sure that what we're focusing on are the people who are marginalized the most. And that would be Black, Brown, Indigenous people. That would be incarcerated people. That would be queer, transgender, non-conforming, non-binary, two-spirit people. I think the approach that many people have is an issue-based approach. And it's already been said, it's already been quoted, we don't live single-issue lives. And we've been tackling, you know, unhoused situations by ourselves, and then we go and we tackle mass incarceration by ourselves, and then we go and tackle food deserts by ourselves, and instead of connecting it all into imperialism, this is what neocolonialism, you know, this is what it caused. This is a result of 400 years. These aren't one-time events. These aren't new horizons, and there's always been a resistance. The reason that I focus on Maroons, one, because of the Afro-indigeneity and the autonomy that they had and the sovereignty that they created within an actual war zone. Being snatched from your source of indigeneity, coming to another place where the indigenous people have been attacked, sometimes running and uniting and connecting, sometimes being pushed by colonialism against each other, but the ability to create something in the middle of all of that, when we're away from our home, having to create a new home, and we're still dealing with those conditions. They built what we know as dual power. They had infrastructure. They had communications, even though it was communications for that time, you know, not technological, but it was, you know, whistles and claps and signals and trees. You know, if branches are turned this way, you know, to go that way. And, you know, the Underground Railroad was not created by the intellectuals and the posh bourgeoisie. Underground Railroad was created by those who were enslaved, by those who were marginalized the most, who were affected by the system. And they created an infrastructure where I'm from, in, from Virginia into North Carolina, in swamps, in forests, wherever they are. Indigenous people are getting more headlines now talking about land-related issues. But I don't feel like the movement focuses enough that this is every square inch of the United States of America was already populated. And you imposed an entire existence on top of that. And then took another mass of people and threw them in for free labor. And I know a lot of people mean well, but I'm having to tell more and more people that they're going to have to jump off the platform of, I call it settler supermanism, wanting to come and save the day instead of giving to, again, not only those who are most marginalized, but who know what the fuck they're talking about, know what they're doing, have experience in resisting the state. We need to see more of that. We need to see more people not taking this as single issues, looking at this as we have to end the empire to be able to do any of the things that we want to do, whether you're talking about police abolition, whether you're talking about prison abolition. We have to come against the state. We have to bring it back to the point that this is anti-imperial, decolonial work. And that has to be led, again, by the most marginalized people. Not as an afterthought. So where is the infrastructure? Don't just post about someone not having water. Why aren't you donating, you know, water purification systems? Or giving the money to the people who are within these communities who know how to do it? Where are the buildings? Where are the boats? Where are the planes? I'm not being, you know, tongue-in-cheek about this. I'm serious. Many of our ancestors, they had underground networks set up, such in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. Underground networks, international. So someone like Kwesi Balogun and Sekou Odinga could free an Assata Shakur from prison, that she helped mastermind herself, and then they could be able to usher her off into Cuba. That didn't just happen. That is organization. That is conversation and communication. That is above ground. That is underground. From the prisons to the streets. And this is what I feel is missing, as everyone is contained in their ideologies and their individualism. We've got to get back to collective struggle, collective organizing, collective work, collective economics. That's my biggest critique of the movement. I'm so happy to see fucking colonizer statues toppled. I'm so happy to see comrades coming together to farm. I'm so happy to see everyone marching with their arms, standing their ground. I'm so happy to see people talking about healing and care. I'm so happy to see Black, brown, indigenous people with the microphones in their hand and the spotlights on what they're doing and what we've been doing for centuries as colonized people. And there needs to be more of that. It needs to be supported. If we say we believe in self-determination and the independence and the choice of individuals to form their own way to their path of liberation, then support that. And this is to anyone. We've had enough lip service, enough liberalism. You know, I haven't been watching my time. I'm kind of going off of the conversations that I've had with people. People want to connect more. People want to form coalitions. And I'm openly asking comrades, if you're watching this, if you're on the call, let's connect our movements. There's no reason that Baltimore and Philly and New York and, you know, shouldn't all be connected. All the way to the Midwest, all the way, you know, out to the West Coast. We should be connected. We should know who's who so that we can have places of safety, where to go to, who to check in with. we've got to get more organized. You know, the Panthers, the Young Lords, AIM, the Brown Berets, so many other groups, you know, they were not perfect, but one thing they did do was communicate in a way that there was an infrastructure. And it actually merged together, such as with, you know, the Weather Underground and the Black Liberation Army and the Republic of New Africa and the Black Panther parties and other groups doing actual resistance together in an underground formations. We've got to get sophisticated enough above ground that we can even trust each other enough to do these underground movement and organizing that is not to be seen, that is not to be heard, that is not to be online. We've got to get our communications right so that we're not always online, you know. It's a lot of things that we need to do, but getting our infrastructure right, getting over these ideological beefs and differences, stop doing shit for the fucking internets that will get people arrested, you know, stop centering the people who are most benefiting from white supremacist imperialism, from heterosexist, you know, patriarchy and homophobia and queerphobia and transphobia, you know, stop centering those individuals and learn to, you know, work horizontally with people who get overlooked all the time. And I understand that because, you know, I'm one of those people. You know, when you're Black, Afro-Indigenous, New African, African, whatever you want to, you know, whatever term you want to use, the exploitation that we face and the erasure that we face is a constant. People are creating their own media. They're creating their own outlets to be heard, their own periodicals, their own blogs. Shout out to Hood Communists, Free Hood Communists, and all the comrades. We're going to have to figure out what our communication and our social media is going to look at, like, since we're facing the censorship of Facebook, YouTube, you know, Twitter, Instagram. Stand alone, dual power, parallel structures to the empire. Because we're not going to abolish anything. We're not going to end anything. These pigs are going to stop killing anything. We're going to have to be the ones who end the state, who ends the empire, who brings it down. And we're going to have to work together to do that. That's just a good intro. I'll leave it at there. I don't know how many minutes that was, but I feel like I'm talking too much. I want to hear the other comrades.
thanks for having me. We were just joking before we started talking that I feel like such a nerd because I wrote all these notes out. So hopefully it won't sound like I'm reading from a bunch of notes, but I'll be echoing a lot of stuff that's already been said. So first of all, I just want to thank the people in so-called Cleveland for putting this together. So nice to see so many events on May Day happening. Hope the barbecue that's going to happen tomorrow in Cleveland goes off without a hitch. So today I just want to like lay out a basic outline of what we think has been happening over the past several years, some lessons from this experience, and where the movement can possibly grow in the coming terrain. It feels right now that we are at a critical stage as Biden enters office. There's rationing tensions between the superpowers, empires repositioning themselves, millions of people are being displaced through neoliberalism, U.S. imperialism, climate change is bringing on disaster after disaster, and the neoliberal consensus is being rocked by the rise of far-right populisms. At the same time, you know, the collapse of state capitalism in the Soviet Union seems like a distant memory, but there's, at the same time, there's a continued rise in autonomous anti-capitalist and anti-colonial currents that are rejecting both social democracy and Leninism. Our ability to defend and sustain these movements and forms of life that can continue to grow over the next several decades, we believe that it's going down will, in our eyes, help decide if humanity has a fighting chance in the coming future. And it's no secret that since 2015, over the last 6 years, we would say that there's been a growth in these currents in so-called North America. We've seen a tapestry of autonomous anti-capitalist and anti-colonial struggles and currents, which have been increasing conversation and struggle with each other. This includes the Black Liberation Struggle, which has grown to become one of the largest mass movements in U.S. history under the banner of Black Lives Matter, At the same time, we've seen an explosion of explicitly abolitionist prison organizing on both sides of the prison walls, which has fundamentally shifted the dialogue around policing and prisons within the U.S. These currents have, you know, culminated in prison strikes and mass rebellions, the most recent of which grew to include millions of people out on the streets. And across U.S., Mexico, and so-called Canada, we've seen increasingly militant and broad indigenous struggles from Standing Rock to towns like Tehran and Michoacan, which have kicked out the state cartels and illegal loggers, to everything we've seen with the shutdown Canada actions, which have rocked the settler state over the past year. And these struggles have touched a lot of people while also engaging them in direct action, advancing an anti-colonial set of politics that questioned the very foundation of the settler state. Moreover, we've also seen the growth of the anti-fascist movement, which exploded in the aftermath of the Charleston massacre, and the deepening connections between Trumpism and the far right. We've seen sustained mass anti-fascist actions and organizing against the far right grow, especially in the wake of Charlottesville, which has brought out tens of thousands into the streets while leading to new coalitions and the centering of fundamental questions about the need for communities to defend themselves and not rely on the state. Moreover, we've seen waves of wildcat strikes and rent strikes, from thousands of wildcat striking teachers in West Virginia to long-term rent strikes, which have created networks of autonomous tenant unions. Through all this, we've seen the growth of anarchist currents alongside other autonomous anti-capitalist and anti-colonial tendencies and formations, which have been on the front lines of many of these already mentioned struggles, along with everything from grassroots responses to COVID-19 in the form of mutual aid, calling for the abolition of ICE, opposing sweeps of houseless encampments, and so many other examples. So the question is, what have we accomplished during this heightened moment of activity? In our view, in short, anarchist ideas, actions, and struggles are more front and center in the popular imagination, more so than they have been for perhaps any other time in recent memory. We've been able to respond to a variety of crises across the vast geographical area to varying degrees of success. And despite attacks from various sides, we've been able to remain resilient in the face of conspiracy theories, targeted fascist violence and murder, state repression, attempts by the left to sideline us, and so on. And while all of these things have taken a massive toll, at the same time, we've also learned to push back on these false narratives, rally against repression, and defend our ideas as best we can. So some lessons learned, as we would say. In the past years, if they've taught us anything, it's that in the face of rising movements from below, there, as we all know about the United States, there's a cross-section of the elites, fascist right, and D-class reactionary strata that can and will form a sizable fascist movement. I know most people listening to this would agree that January 6th did not take any of us off guard. We were not surprised. We saw this coming. We had already seen this in further actions, that something like this was going to happen. And we've watched similar scenes like this play out across the U.S. as the U.S. far right has called for mass murder and state-sanctioned violence, specifically against us and other social movements. And those calls have been growing for years. Meanwhile, the last few years, we've been able to see within the repressive state apparatus through FOIA documents being released that things like fusion centers are labeling Black Lives Matter groups as hate groups. They're taking stupid conspiracy theories from InfoWars as reality. We've watched in real time as the police have sided with the far right on the streets against anti-fascists. We've learned that the FBI and the DHS have an Iron Fist program to target so-called black identity extremists. We've watched as there's been a barrage of states pass laws targeting Black Lives Matter demonstrators and Native water protectors and so on and so on. So we see a ratcheting up on a massive scale of state repression. But we've also learned that state counterinsurgency doesn't just come in the form of grand juries and federal charges and new laws against protesting, but also through a network of online far-right trolls that push and spread disinformation all the way up to Fox News and even into the White House. And also on the other side, during the George Floyd rebellion, liberals we watched also work to push the narrative that everything from anarchists to cartels to white supremacists were behind the revolt, tricking the quote good people into burning down quote their own cities and kicking off a rebellion, which of course was not true. These people sought to throw a wet blanket on the fires of revolt and divide people in the street that were fighting in the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd. And liberal, in many cases, neoliberal talking points were more destructive than anything the far right was able to feed into their base of an echo chamber. So just looking forward, as the hosts of this have already said, we face, you know, changing terrain. As expected with Biden in office, many people are opting to stay home, or at least some people are. Although anger remains high as the recent round of rebellions that kicked off after the police murder of Dante Wright show, many people are still activated. Many people are still on the streets. But as a lot of people have been saying recently on our podcast, for sure, that the task now at hand is to really consolidate the gains, as many people have been saying, over the recent social struggles and movements and rebellions that have been popping off. And this, for us, means most of all forging relationships with people that have only perhaps known themselves through interactions in the streets in the past couple months. So the work ahead of us means a lot of things. To us, it means building a healthy, multi-generational movement that has concrete ways for everyday people to get involved in it. It means working to create survival programs, as already been talked about on this panel discussion, on a broad scale. The continued growth and proliferation of autonomous formations, whether inside prisons, on the streets, and workplaces, or in tenant associations. The building up of anti-repression defenses as more and more charges continue to stem from the George Floyd rebellion. The cultivation of a movement that seeks dialogue with the rest of society. If more people are listening to us, we need the ability to continue to have these conversations with people. And also the continued intervention and action within the wider social terrain as things continue to pop off. And in closing, I just want to lay out a couple possible ideas for moving forward. You know, as we've said on our show many times, being part of an organization is not necessarily synonymous with being organized. But we have to work towards getting organized in every way possible. And going forward, we'd really like to see people cultivate regional networks on the ground where they live. That means building grassroots connections, coalitions, relationships with people around the general area where you're at, and working to strengthen those regional bonds to increase our level of trust and confidence with each other. So when things happen, we have networks and groups of people that are ready to respond. We also need to work to support people that are in rural areas and projects that are outside of major cities, and work to build up those connections with folks that may be isolated or lack the capacity or infrastructure that are in the bigger areas. And just in closing, we would say that supposedly we're coming out of this pandemic, and as we venture back into the world and begin holding meetings and events face-to-face, whenever that may be, if that does happen, let's try to make an effort to meet face-to-face, to potentially squash internet beefs, forge real-world relationships, and get offline as much as possible. Let's also think about how we continue to interact with the public in a real way once it becomes safe to do so in a closed setting. And, you know, we look forward to the return of barbecues, film screenings, discussions on current topics, speaking tours, and some of the things that are already being planned tomorrow on May Day. And I'm just going to close with that and look forward to more discussion and questions.
Yate. Yate ataha saint lo. She e kli dasha jinne. Todich eatni shabashis chi nado nakadine dashanella. Shama e beetha chi e auto. Beetha chi dasha che. Zithajin date nasha auto kinthanisha hawan. My name is Kli Benali. I'm originally from Black Mesa on the Diné or Navajo Nation. Currently, I reside in this small town called Flagstaff at the base of Dakota Sleet, one of six holy mountains for our people, Diné. It's also a holy mountain for 13 indigenous nations that we've been fighting to protect for some years. Thank you for the invitation. I'm honored to speak with such powerful forces such as Frank and Sima. I also understand that you're having a picnic tomorrow with perhaps some uninvited guests.
Yes, we are. Hopefully everything goes well and the police don't decide that anarchists having a picnic is a national security issue.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit about that before we started the broadcast. Well, just don't let your picnic turn into a Thanksgiving and I think you'll be okay.
We will definitely not let it turn into a Thanksgiving.
You better not. It's a challenge. You know, I find myself trying to locate a balance amidst the list of actions, achievements, and action calls, really amidst what feels like a kind of optimism or searching for. Not that I'm a pessimist, but perhaps I've been working too closely with my unsheltered relatives here on the streets in this so-called border town where there is an extraordinary continuation of colonial violence that we face every day. So I think tonight I just feel a little bit more negative. And so I offer perspective from the base of this holy mountain from a small, very small occupied community, where I've tended to a lot of activist-y campaigns and some exciting radical projects. I think I must state that Diné Bekea, a lot of folks know, the Navajo Nation, has faced and endured the highest rate per capita of COVID-19 cases, more so than any settler colonial U.S. state at one point during this pandemic. I will state that colonial violence and violence against the earth has made our people more susceptible to this virus. And so it's also not the first virus that we've faced. I think it's an important thing to name in relation to what we're talking about today. Before we talk about futurity or the future, we must discuss the cartography of hope and despair. This, of course, is something that has already been mapped before us. It exists within the realm of nightmares and dreams, of utopian fantasies and their brutal colonial legacies, sometimes something just like a picnic. It also is the language of an apocalypse that it has been de-metaphorized. It is the hellscape open season on black kin by enforcers of colonial law. It is our relatives starving, evicted from their homes, our children, indigenous children, in cages, all while this economic exploitation matrix profits from this mass suffering. It kills oceans and produces billionaires. It expands its infrastructure with pipelines through sacred lands and water and proposes to colonize on a multi-planetary level. We've mapped our despairs through the losses we can count as scars on our mother, which are scars on our own skin as we are the original peoples of this earth. Though I'm trying my best not to just offer a doom polemic this evening, especially since we're discussing May Day, state violence, capitalism, and the future. In notes to May Day, I recently posted something that I think is important in relation to our mobilizations to recognize that labor was and still is complicit in the building and maintaining of colonial structures. And so that's really not just a statement, but an invitation to bring those hands to join us in tearing those structures down. And since you're asking us tonight to imagine, to share vision, to offer prediction, or perhaps a bit of what might be possible in relation to where we can go from here, that, I guess, is what is also expected of the organizers. But I'm no specialist. I'm really tethered to a chain of experiences and experiments. Sometimes I'm holding the megaphone because it's louder than the other tools. If I knew how to do struggle better, tactically, strategically, and so forth, I would have more victories than losses. And some of those losses have been very heavy, mostly spiritually so. But that's another dimension to this story. Is the future so enticing because in its dreaming, it's the only space where we are truly free? Part of what I think the trouble is in locating these spaces where we connect in possible moments, when we connect with others who perhaps share the same ballistics of dreams. I recently re-listened to a podcast conversation I had with an old friend, another indigenous anarchist who has since passed into the spirit world. And we discussed this actual very topic as an urge to locate a space where attention would grow beyond the meager radical folds we were familiar with. This activist theater, the leftist trappings, and now somewhere in between the breaths of our ancestors in the seventh generation, we have a fire we barely imagined was possible. And this is the ballistics of dreams. Although we share these powerful moments, though, I don't think we should necessarily pin our analysis on any specific point. To do so in many ways plays into the trappings of an exceptionalism that seems born from the same frontier logics that shape the political project of America. And state violence, particularly the execution of Black, Indigenous people of color, is embedded deeply, deeply within that narrative. I know that most of us here feel that we are on the edge of a precipice, more so than most realize. And perhaps that's why we've been called from these dreams. Before we claim the future, I think it's important to be clear about the present and the overall topic for the discussion. And this means context and coming to terms with some shit, a lot of shit, if we were to meaningfully discuss any proposals for liberation. We have survived massacres and forced marches. We have endured reservations and boarding schools. We have faced forced sterilizations and national sacrifice zones. We have resisted attacks on Mother Earth, as we have long held that the balance and harmony of creation is intrinsically tied to our well-being and the health of all living beings. Our immune systems are compromised due to colonial diets and ecocide, from abandoned uranium mines poisoning our lands and waters to coal mining, fracking, oil pipelines, and desecration of our most sacred sites. We have become more susceptible to this and other diseases due to capitalism and colonialism. Our prophecies warned of the consequences for violating Mother Earth. Our ways of being have guided us through the endings of worlds before. We listen now more than ever to our ancestors, the land, and our medicine carriers. In these times, we care for each other more fiercely than ever. We are living in the time of our prophecies. You know, the system that precipitated this disharmony, we understand, will not lead us through or out of it. They will only take up the task of crafting new chains and new cages. As this sickness ravages our lands, we must ask ourselves, and I think each and every one of us have done this in different ways, will we continue to allow this empire to recuperate? Here in the so-called Southwest, I've grown up in a world of ruins, and we have the teachings and prophecies of the ending of cycles, but that's always really how it's been here. It's only been something that has been an oddity to study by anthropologists and archaeologists, but that's where we exist in this world of harmony and disharmony and destruction. An anti-colonial and anti-capitalist world already exists. And my father, who is a traditional medicine practitioner or Hatatli, has always, since I was young, instructed that there aren't two worlds here, just one world crossed by many paths. And so with that understanding, in the comparison or the distinction between the colonial and capitalist paths, they're linear by design. They have a beginning, a middle, and an end. In the space between harmony and devastation, we listen to these cycles because we are people of cycles. In this space between this devastation, we listen to the land and we conspire. If the path of greed, domination, exploitation, and competition doesn't accept that it's reached its dead end, then it's up to us to make sure of it. There are some of us who gather around sacred fires and name that our project is to replace the principle of political authority with the principle of autonomous indigenous mutuality. This is a mutuality with the earth and all beings. It's not ahistorically romantic as it exists out of the imposition of settler time. It is a process of collective healing. And so to respond to the questions and the prompts that we had for the discussion tonight, what I can offer as far as what I've learned is that my spirit is tired of marching. And, you know, just a note, in this small town, Kintlana or Occupied Flagstaff, we had some powerful marches throughout the last summer in response to the call for action because of the murder of George Floyd and the range of murders that continued to happen successively in succession over the summer. And at one point, even though I've been organizing and calling for so many marches in this town, it just felt like my heart had been starved, and it's very particular on what it feeds on. And so perhaps one thing I can share that I've learned is sometimes it's only satisfied with broken glass and the smell of sage mixed with the toxic smoke of burning cop cars. The civil disobedience activist theater and nonviolent direct action is a bit pointless during this pandemic. The production of movement police necessitates extreme intervention. And what else I've learned, I guess, that would be relevant to this discussion is that mutual aid is necessary, but it can be co-opted very easily. So we should be aggressively explicit with that in our organizing. And that's why when we say Indigenous mutual aid is necessary, but it isn't just about the radical redistribution of resources. It's also about the radical redistribution of power and what we mean by that we have to understand. As far as what I can offer for approaches that can be taken to move resistance forward, aside from what I've already stated, I will state that whatever it is, it will be rage. I can assure you that we will rapidly refuse to let it be mediated by the politics of settler colonizers and whiteness. And this is a space for a special fuck you to the MLMers and authoritarians or tankies. That means you. If we understand state repression as the maintenance of national security, perhaps the question to ask is, what do I have as far as resources, skills, capacity, and so forth to enhance and accelerate national insecurity? We can also look to historical matters and movements from the BLA to the Green Scare and note that the calculation of state repression produces more extremism, not less, but also that our tactics will become more desperate with the less clean air we have to breathe, the less clean water we have to drink, and the less clean soil we have to plant. To fully stop these mines, power plants, dams, and pipelines, we also have to stop the political machinery and systems that are generating them. This means proportionate interventions, which comes with proportionate risks, and we have to be real and clear about that. With some of the crew at indigenousaction.org, we published a short piece titled 16 Things You Can Do to Be Ungovernable, P.S. Fuck Biden. And I'll close with just this short section on that, which we assert that we have been refusing domination, control, and exploitation in these lands by colonial forces since 1492. Being ungovernable means we pledge no allegiance to colonial authority, nor are we dependent upon their systems for our survival, identity, belonging, or well-being. In the face of COVID-19 and more overt fascism, we celebrate the powerful expressions of unmediated direct action and interventions against capitalism, white supremacy, cis-heteropatriarchy, and the colonial police state. From the powerful Black Lives Matter uprisings to tearing down of racist statues, from autonomous zones to the thousands of mutual aid projects throughout Turtle Island providing necessary supplies and support, our communities have been taking direct action in building alternative infrastructure for generations so that we are not dependent on the state or corporations. We seek to organize and intervene as directly as possible in the root causes that uphold oppressive social orders while working to creatively build and support alternatives based on mutual aid, dignity, and collective self-determination beyond capitalism. We are ungovernable, and we must make it impossible for this colonial system to govern on stolen land. Build, sustain, and proliferate autonomous organizing and organizations, and embrace your role in these struggles. Yeah, thank you for having me, and I'm looking forward to the dialogue.
Yes, thank you for that. So I think at this point in the panel, we are going to open this up for any of the speakers. If any of the speakers on the panel have any follow-up comments they would like to sort of articulate and discuss. I also have been aggregating a number of questions myself, as we've been going that I think would be interesting for discussion. So, before we really dive into those questions or any questions from the audience, do any of the speakers have any follow-up comments that they would like to make?
Queer, trans, gender non-conforming, non-binary, two-spirit people are fucking tired. And in particular, my trans and gender non-conforming fam, we are fucking tired. And we are fucking not listened to. And we're tired of performance solidarity. And that needs to be handled. and only, you know, only cis hetero patriarchal, you know, folks and heterosexists and people who feel that they are allies, but they still step on and speak over, our community, can handle that. We can say it till we're blue in the face, but that's your job to check your shit. And we're tired. We are being harmed at disproportionate levels. And the tokenism and the mouth, you know, all the mouth talking and you know, talking out the side of your neck, that's what we used to call it. It's not getting us anywhere. And this is, again, when I'm talking about people who are the most marginalized. We're tired, and we're not coming from a position of begging and so forth. We are asserting our autonomy. And I want to give a shout out to Baltimore Safe Haven, which is the group of Black trans organizers here in Baltimore who are kicking ass and meeting the needs that so many people have promised, you know, queer, trans, gender non-conforming communities. They are doing it on their own, and it is fucking amazing. And I want to salute everyone who's doing that through the fear, through the pain, through the tension, through the anger. Century after century of being marginalized, having your entire gender taken away. There are genders that we have lost in the process of colonialism and settlerism, and people are trying to reclaim who they are. I think when some people say decolonize, they don't understand how deep that goes. It goes deep. We have been taken away from our history, our lineage, our story, our path, and we're trying to forge our own now. So I would like to see, if I didn't make that loud enough, not just checking off a box if you have a queer, trans, gender non-conforming person on your panel or in your, you know, whatever, but actual true solidarity and people checking their fucking privilege while people are being murdered. So yeah, I had to say that because I don't think I expressed that enough.
So in listening to everyone, I definitely have, come up with a series of questions. These questions kind of break down into, questions about sort of shifting paradigms in the way that we think about resistance work, which has been a lot of the discussion today. There's some questions about tactics, and there's actually a lot of questions about community, right? And how we sort of build and maintain those things with, you know, inclusion in mind and central to everything, while also sustainability being a part of this, right? So I think it probably makes sense for us to start off with discussions of kind of high level sort of questions of activism. And I've sort of got three questions in this area, but very specifically, I think the one that I want to start off with is one that I know I've been talking to a lot of people about over the recent period of time. But one of the things that I think people on this panel have expressed and that I definitely have experienced myself is that a lot of political work in the United States has a series of almost given inevitable normative assumptions behind it. Sometimes those are assumptions around single issue activism. Sometimes those are assumptions about the institutions like the state. Sometimes they're assumptions about the inevitability of the police, right? I think one of the more interesting points that was made in the book In Defense of Looting was how things like slavery were also thought of as inevitable in the 1850s. And that it was through the work of slaves and escaped slaves that that was destroyed, that was entirely sort of incinerated, right? And all of a sudden the idea of slavery now, for at least many of us, is horrendous, right? So how do we start to push through some of these assumptions, right? And how do we do that in such a way which allows us to identify who our friends and allies and accomplices are and should be?
I mean, I think that the question really is about how do we embody our intentions? That's something that we should be asking ourselves in what we do with every part of our organizing, and whether we're being strategic or not about it. It's the logic behind our strategies. It's the logic that informs the way we respond to certain things. So these assumptions are core, and, you know, we can talk about propagandizing, the very specific points that we are addressing with these systems of oppression, these structures. We can talk about, you know, the exciting opportunities, and ways to make that as, attractive, desirable as possible. I think that each and every one of us represents in our work, whether, it's with the Maroon cast, whether it's going down, but even with Indigenous Action, we're always asking ourselves this question. And that's why we're putting ourselves out there in our work like this. Because, you know, part of the power relationship, the underlying assumption is that that relationship is never really challenged. And I think that that's why it's critical to also have these very incisive root cause analyses. So, you know, I'm a proponent of propaganda of the deed as well, of finding exemplary places for action. I think the points of intervention exist not just at the point of assumption, but everywhere in every space that we're in.
Right now, how I'm cutting through, well, first of all, right now, I've been doing a lot of self-assessment, a lot of constructive criticism towards myself, self-critique. What am I not doing? Who am I not reaching out to? Why am I not reaching out to them? Is it ideological? Is it personal? Is it subjective? Am I just tripping? Am I bugging? You know, is it petty? You know, you have to go through a list of things. Why am I not talking to this person? Why am I not working with that person? I'm in community. Like I often say, we're thrust into community sometimes, neighborhoods, hoods, barrios, reses, suburbs, but that doesn't mean that you're in the community with people. So, challenge yourself and ask yourself, are you really in the community to be able to build the type of relationships that we're talking about? Every damn interview I give, I talk about that was the basis of what Maroon House was about. One, because I'm trying to get us another house, another space, so that we can continue to open up and build like that. And so people can take it with them and be like, damn, that's not so hard. You mean you just came out in the middle of your community and just set out a table and took some food out and some music and started talking political shit. And then the next thing you know, you organize some shit. Yeah. Because actually, when you put aside things that are not, contributing to the oppression of other people, and it is just subjective shit, you know, if you put your ego aside, you can get a lot of things accomplished. We have grievances with people who we don't even fucking know, you know, for reasons that are, again, not ideological, not based upon principles. So having a trajectory, you know, like Klee said, an intention. I'm a Buddhist. I don't like to bring spirituality into a lot of things, but one of the things about Buddhism is that I was impressed with from a non-theistic aspect, because I'm more of a non-theistic Buddhist, is that it's about your right view and your right intention, because that sets forth everything else that you're doing. And if you have that clear-cut idea of what it is that you want, you'll be reaching out to a lot of people. A lot of people are afraid of embarrassment, rejection, you know. It took me a lot to open up my fucking doors and let strangers in, y'all. I don't think y'all really... A house full of women and femmes who are queer and trans in the middle of the capital of the empire itself. Saying, come in, cis people. Come in, you know, anti-racist white people. Come in, you know, black, brown, indigenous, Asian. Come in and let's build and look for solutions. I had to really put it all out on the line with my PTSD, with my anxiety, with my depression, all of that. With fear that undercovers were in there. There's no guarantee to this shit. There's no, I know this is going to work. I think Klee alluded to that. Like, if there was a fucking blueprint, wouldn't we all be following it? But if you don't even go out and have the conversations and push yourself past your cliques, your idea, you know, your sectarianism, then you're not going to be able to see who is a worthy accomplice. I love to be able to say that when Klee's on the line, like, you know. Accomplices and our allies, like, that's how we get there. We really have to, I think we overthink things a lot, and we think that that's being secure, and then a lot of other shit, we're not even doing security culture. Like, shit's just wide open. So, like, we really need to analyze that. I understand security culture, but don't let that keep you from connecting with individuals, and not just organizers, but everyone in your community has a say-so. In liberation, and you don't know what that missing puzzle piece is going to be until you actually engage in everyday struggle.
Okay, so one of the things that has come up repeatedly on this panel so far has been that this work is hard, right? Like, I know I've been doing this for about 20 years. I know a lot of other people that have been as well. This work is really difficult, and it can be really draining, and it can lead to a lot of trauma. And, you know, we experience violence in the context of this work a lot. At the same time, one of the things that I've noticed over the years is that we tend to have this concept of political revolt, which is centered around a notion of joy, right? That we go out there. We have this like joyful rebellion. All of a sudden everything magically changes, blah, 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 blah. I think those of us that have been around for a while know that that's not necessarily how things happen. And so the question is, how do we start to discuss with newer participants, or even maybe more, for lack of a better term, naive older participants, about things that are difficult, about suffering, about trauma, about violence? In a way which is not intimidating, right? And in a way which allows us to be realistic about the risks and the stakes of what we're doing.
You want me to, I can jump in on that real quick.
Please.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think there's actually a couple of parts and some assumptions with the question, but, I think we have to be intentional again about, you know, like who we are talking about, what spaces. And so like as organizers, we create spaces. And what our practice has been specifically at Talahuan Info Shop and a range of other projects based upon really bad experiences that we've had is to set those intentions through agreements, to be very upfront about the challenges. And it's just this cliche statement that they don't call it a struggle for a reason. I think this is part of the problem when we have certain histories that are washed over with whatever color, like the American Indian movement, for example, and its extreme cis-hetero patriarchy, and we don't own that and learn the lessons from that, then we have, you know, further perpetuate and enable that violence. And so I think we have to have those conversations built into the framework of our agreements in our intention setting. So we do that with our organizing, with Kintana Mutual Aid, with the Indigenous Mutual Aid stuff. We have very specific agreements regarding that, those lines, and are upfront. Like, I think, and this gets into some of the shortcomings of security culture and how we need to be more explicit about bringing in, conversations about sexual violence and oppressive behaviors as part of what make our cultures insecure, and have the mechanisms, the processes, identify ways to check that behavior before it spins out of control. Because a lot of times when we don't have those conversations, we open up ourselves to be vulnerable to predators, either sexual predators or predators of the state, as well. And so I think having those agreements, having processes built in on some levels to our communities, because we can talk a shit ton about security culture. We can talk about knowing their laws. But can we articulate on the same lines, transformative and restorative justice responses, how we are going to hold accountable, perpetrators of sexual violence in our communities? I think that needs to be one and the same built into security culture and start with those approaches from the get-go. So, I also think we need to be sensitive about trauma, but I mean, we got to be real and honest that like a lot of our communities, it's like, we're not fucking trying to sugarcoat anything. Like, I mean, pretty much every day I work with unsheltered relatives on the street. There's nothing to sugarcoat. There's nothing to hide behind. You know, we're working with our communities that are ravaged by COVID-19 and, you know, this sort of victimhood narrative. We break that shit down in a dignified way though. And we are upfront. We're honest. None of these conversations can be dishonest on that level. And one more note regarding this, is that even in our spaces, Talahuan Info Shop, we assert as a space of conflict infrastructure and that we're not a safe space. At some point we decided that, we cannot guarantee that our spaces excludes, the behaviors and actions outside of this space, but only that we can assure that we are a threatening space to all these forms of abusive behavior. And so that known abusers are not welcome and they will, and any kind of abusive behaviors, actions and so forth will be dealt with accordingly, that we empower everybody who comes inside to be threats. And that to me, I think is an important component of that sort of security culture minded, trauma, informed approach to addressing these issues, which I think are key. And it's important to be honest. I mean, I don't think that's going to scare most of our people away. I'm not interested in coddling people or creating false, like, ideas of comfortability. And I guess that's what, you know, I'm not sure if that's what we're getting at with your question. But I think it's just important to be honest and upfront. But also building in the processes. So we're not scaring people off, but we understand how we are being responsible, how we are being accountable to these issues and our intentions.
I think it's important to also realize that everyone's culture is different and everyone's expression of joy isn't that there are some naive people who don't understand what's going on. In particular, Black and, you know, Afro-Indigenous, New Africans, you know, we have our ways of expressing joy that might, to some people, they've been saying it for years, well, y'all are like, y'all just don't give a fuck. No, we give a fuck. Like, you're killing us. You're keeping us in the worst of conditions. You know, we have generational poverty, generational trauma, four centuries of being disconnected from who we are. Like, you know, sometimes our joy is a sign of resistance and I was going to say something, but I don't want the feds to, you know, but we've been known to celebrate sometimes after, you know, we got down and got busy with some colonizers and some settlers. So, you know, don't mistake our joy for naivete. But for those who are new to formations and don't really, you know, understand, that's our job. You know, it's not our job to be the old fucking fuddy-duddy who's scaring everybody and, you know, I lost my leg in the last time in the World Trade. You know, like, that's, you know, you weren't in Seattle, were you? I got some glass in my throat. And, you know, we keep it real about our experiences and historical, not to put people up on platforms. I'm glad Clee mentioned AIM because I'm constantly having to do that with the you know, deconstructing what people thought about the Panthers and other formations, the Black Liberation Movement, because there was plenty of heteropatriarchy, abuse, and all sorts of things. But those are teaching, you know, these are teachable moments. These are things that you can use to show where we don't want to head, what we don't want to emulate, and create what it is that we feel is safety or as safe as can be in the middle of a war, in the middle of a fucking war. The youth, they know what the fuck is going on. Are you kidding me? Especially Black and brown indigenous youth, they're getting stopped by the cops. They're getting fucked up. Half the shit, they don't even tell adults. You know, we've got to be, as adults, make it comfortable for the youth to even confide. They're holding on to serious secrets of abuse from the state and from other people, and they don't feel comfortable always coming to adults. We've got to check our shit as adults to make people who are young and new coming into the movement who have their own experiences and their own toughness and their own realities and their own defenses to be able to listen to them. It feels like a lot of times people want to preach to people instead of learn and grow with them at the same time. You know, you offer your experiences and you try to keep somebody falling into the fire, but you respect their autonomy and their life experiences as well. And if we do that, you know, I think that we can be honest about past mistakes, current mistakes, and patterns that are abusive and how not to continue those. You know, it keeps me hopeful. The youth actually are coming in with some incredible analysis that people that I know in their 30s and 40s aren't even implementing half the shit that I see a lot of these youth movements doing, especially around gender, sexual orientation, trauma-informed, you know, healing circles. They're pushing that. Some of this is because we've pushed things towards them and we've been able to expose them and they've been able to take it a step further. But we have a lot of giving and take to do with even with people who we think are naive and new into formations. Everybody has something to say. All of their experiences are valid. So just be open-minded about that and don't assume that someone doesn't really know what's going on.
Okay. I want to break it down maybe a little bit to personal experience, right? As opposed to like broad, big conceptual questions, but really kind of breaking it down into things that we've experienced in our political work and how that can help inform some of what we're talking about going forward. So Sima brought up the question of infrastructure, right? And this idea that infrastructure is sort of absolutely key. I know this is something we talk about locally a lot. This is talked about in the IGD podcast. I know Indigenous Action has talked about stuff like this. Infrastructure is this really important thing. And it feels at times, and the thing I've heard when I've talked to people about this before, is that there's a sense in which that feels really big, right? Like, it feels like we have to build, like, a Breakfast for Kids program for, like, 300 people, and it feels big and intimidating and difficult and hard to really conceive of if you're not in the middle of it sometimes. And so I guess what the question I have for you all is, what are some of the ways that you've thought about things that have allowed you to sort of push in that direction? How do you approach the questions of scale, right? And how intimidating that can feel, especially for those of us that live in really large cities. And what does that look like kind of going forward, right? Like, what does it look like for us to expand these things, start to bring them together, start to network them?
Right now, I'm connected loosely to a network here in Baltimore. And it kind of organically came together. I'm not saying that's always the best thing to do, but there were different groups all over the city that have always been consistently working with our unhoused neighbors, working with people who, you know, need food assistance, clothing assistance, shelter assistance. And we kind of gravitated together to have, you know, big events, with massive amounts of food and hot meals and clothing and toiletries and PPE and books. And again, that kind of just came together because people were already doing the work. And it goes back to me saying, go to people's shit, you know, go to people's shit, support people's shit, and form alliances. Because if you think that you're going to do it with your individual affinity group or large member group, like, it doesn't matter. Like, nobody can do, the scale of the need that is underneath capitalism is massive. It is massive. More people go to bed hungry than people think. More people who do not have adequate clothing and shelter than people think. So there's no one group. There's no super group that's going to take on all of the feeding and clothing and so on and so forth. But building up those alliances, you'll be able to create the infrastructure. For example, in DC, we used to have the DC Free Store. Then it became the DC Really Free Market because, again, other people that were doing mutual aid, they just kind of gravitated together and figured out, well, who's not doing something? How do we get this person to be added into the framework? I'm making it seem like it's simplistic, but again, I think a lot of times we read such deep texts and we read such heroic stories of young lords taking over, you know, a church, and the next thing you know, it's clinic. And, you know, those things seem brave and heroic because it is anytime we're going up against the state, but a lot of time it's just basic good old fashioned relationships and good old fashioned talking and communication. Now I know who are all the people that are on the ground. Now I know it's easier to be able to build a rapid response team because I know who the mediators are who are trained. If we need self-defense training, I'm getting to know who can be able to do that. It's just basic. It's like grassroots 101, to be honest, to be able to build these types of networks and infrastructure like that. It's just basic grassroots. You go out, you go to people's shit and you support, and you don't look people over because they're not in a group or because they don't have the same ideological background as you. I've had to work with people who are Christians. I'm not a Christian. I've had to work with people who, and I say I've had to because there were times when, you know, it was very uncomfortable for me growing up in the church, queer and so on and so forth. I eventually became Muslim. I eventually became Buddhist. These are personal choices, you know, spiritual choices, and learning more about Afro-Indigenous, traditional, what we call African traditional religions. And I say that to say that someone like me wouldn't always work with church people. But for temporary purposes, the Black church I've found, while it can be rooted in a lot of things that we don't want in the community, there are also a lot of people who are in it, and it's just their culture, and they're not as liberal or conservative as one might think, and looking to be radicalized and looking to connect with people. And, you know, so I've been able to connect with grandmothers who, you know, who wouldn't ordinarily be talking about, you know, fuck the police, but end up saying fuck the police just because of the relationships that we built. And not only is she saying fuck the police, she sews, she makes clothing. She could teach clothing class, you know, classes, how people can sew and make their own clothing. And she knows someone and she knows someone. That is how we ran our entire program, by word of mouth and people bringing more people together to the bigger picture until it just becomes this massive thing. You start off block by block, and then you make it, you know, more of a mass thing, connecting it to other national groups. If you're trying to go that route, if you think you can do it all your own, then hey, you know, go for it. But if you're trying to build a network, that's how you do it. It starts in your own neighborhood, and you take the block by block tactics and it's easier. I'm not saying that it's foolproof, but I'm saying you're not going to get around doing grounds, you know, boots on the ground work. You're not going to get around it. You know, it might not seem fancy, but that's what the fuck organizing is, you know?
The mutual aid projects that have developed, as somebody that's had the opportunity to, you know, interview folks across, you know, such a vast area and just see the different experiments and the things that people are building. I mean, I remember just to kind of echo the sentiment of like, you know, reading stuff and hearing about, past projects and just feeling in awe. Like I remember when we talked to, Scott Crow and just, hearing about the networks of clinics that were set up in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina and like the Common Ground Collective and just kind of that feeling like, how could we ever kind of like make something like that? And then just seeing the mutual aid projects and programs that people have developed over the past couple of years. I mean, the stories, are just so inspiring to me, you know, being able to hear people talk about them. I mean, people like literally flying planes into areas that were hit by hurricanes that the state hadn't even been to, people setting up storefronts. I mean, Klee can obviously talk about everything that they've done in their area over just such like a vast, vast, area is just really inspiring. We've obviously talked to Simile, several times about mutual aid programs. I mean, I just think it's amazing what people have built. I think the question now is, not that COVID is going away. It's actually getting worse in a lot of ways, but, if in theory it's gone at some point, how do we transition these projects into, survival programs? And also too, you know, is there a way to make these more political? Like, can we incorporate like, political education, within them in ways that maybe we haven't done before? I think these are all big questions. I think the good thing is that at least a lot of people right now have a lot of experience, or if perhaps you don't, maybe somebody close to you or that you're in contact with has had experience setting up these programs. So I just think that it's a question of like experimentation and, you know, trying to build off of what's already been accomplished, but also using these projects as a way of base building. You know, who are we relating to? Who are we talking to? Who do we want to support or engage with us? And I think that, these programs are definitely a launch pad for that. But I think that, for sure we should, continue to engage with mutual aid and continue to think about it critically and just go forward. And I think the stuff that's been created so far has been really inspiring. I mean, it's been amazing to see some of the stuff that people have been creating. I mean, like I was just thinking about the last thing I'll say on this topic is, an interview we did with folks in the Southeast, creating like, regional supply hubs and supply chains in the lead up to some of the hurricanes. So people were like, gathering up supplies and different like trucks and like U-Haul stuff and then bringing that down to a hub. And people from other cities were doing the same thing, and then they were using that as distribution hubs and so on and so forth. I mean, so many of these things can be applied to so many other aspects of different struggles and different things that we're building. And, you know, hopefully we can remember these projects going forward and just continue to experiment.
And by base building, you meant not the like non-profit-y activist jargon, but actually building militant bases for liberation, right?
Yeah.
yeah, I just wanted to add real quick. It's interesting that because infrastructure, I guess I'm old enough at this point, I've been around long enough in these sort of like radical scenes that infrastructure used to actually mean info shops. But what it means today is something I think entirely different almost. Info shops sort of have their use, but because of the information, you know, technological age, I guess on this level, it has shifted their purpose. It used to be that we only had zines and people traveling through our, you know, communities on fucking bands on tour, people tabling, especially in the smaller, spread out rural communities. we'd hardly get information unless we had these radical, you know, information distribution hubs. And so infrastructure can mean a lot of things. It's up to us. It can be nodes, pods, networks. It can be spaces. It can be anti-spaces. It can be online. It can be offline. I think we're just limited by our creativity. I think the example of the mutual aid projects in response to COVID-19 is extraordinarily representational of very inspiring, very powerful, spaces. And there are a lot of networks, like, was mentioned earlier, we started an Indigenous Mutual Aid Network, and it's a pretty strong network. We meet, quite a bit, and we share resources and do all the things that you expect networks to do. I do want to note that infrastructure doesn't mean institutionalization. I think a lot of times we get invested as organizers into like institutionalizing that infrastructure, and we forget that, some shit needs to be composted. Like some shit should happen in cycles. Like we can look to different markers historically and be like, that was a fucking amazing, you know, project. Too bad that's not around today, but it probably was composted for various reasons and it hopefully fertilized the soil so other things could grow. And I think that's the best thing that we could expect from some things that end. So I think it's important for us, especially if you want to organize a project or you're in the midst of a project and you're holding on to it, sometimes it's good to let go of shit so other things can grow. But on the tip of like folks who are looking to create established infrastructure, I mean, we've had Tullo and InfoShop now since 2007, which is odd that it's like one of the older InfoShops now in the so-called US. But I think it's about stabilizing, like one, it's looking for the smallest opportunity. There's the smallest possibility and finding ways to make that grow and just focusing on that regardless of like the scale of like, you know, if you live in a large city or small place, and then focus on stabilizing that. And then the question is about proliferating. So how can you proliferate that, or how can you network to create a bit of proliferation in relation to folks who have the same affinity? The question of scale, I think, is contextual. There's some shit that shouldn't be scaled, but it's just a question of like strategy, I guess, in what we're looking to proliferate. And I think particularly that's why conflict infrastructure, or the notion of conflict infrastructure, is really key and interesting. Is basically creating like what our InfoShop has sort of emerged into is a conflict infrastructure that is a direct action resource hub, that is anti-colonial and anti-capitalist space around the region. So we organize and we launch actions and we support and sustain actions out of the space, and we spread our work and we don't centralize it, just tie it into that specific space. So we give people like a sort of a space where they can base their organizing and then just keep building from there. And we've done the same thing with our mutual aid organizing with Kintlena Mutual Aid. We've helped to like stabilize other projects because we have the infrastructure, we have access to resources. And just another note regarding infrastructure, I think it's like, I just want to just, you know, air that, I'm personally tired of lifestyle projects that amount to settlers answering that question. And responding how they can be more sustainable, like what they can do to sustain those like unsustainable ways of life in, and essentially by extension, normalize settler colonial occupation. So, hopefully that offers something. I think it's an interesting question because when we started in 2007, we were working with a very small group of Indigenous youth that were really rabid, radical, excited to protect sacred spaces. And we recognized we needed a space. And we thought it would be great to have an info shop. So we just had all these meetings and just decided not to organize everything before we had a space, but just got a space and just built from there. And it worked out. And we're still here to some degree, for better or for worse.
Again, I mean, this work is hard and it's draining. And I know, Clea, you specifically mentioned like this work can be incredibly spiritually and emotionally draining. It can be really hard, and losing can feel really hard. Winning can feel really hard. I think what I would love for people to speak to a bit is, what are some of the things that you all do in your own lives to allow you to keep going, or know when it's time to take a break, or just kind of keep yourself moving in some kind of direction if that's the decision that you think is important.
I'll stab at that first. I'm a spiritual person. I do a lot of meditation and fasting. Kind of a ancestor veneration as far as there are certain traditions for Black, New African, Afro-Indigenous people in colonized Turtle Island, traditions that where we brought some of our indigenous, you know, backgrounds from Africa to Turtle Island, and also things that were forced upon us through the Europeans and the colonizers. We kind of meshed and formed our own traditions and beliefs. And one of them is hoodoo. And it's very, it's just the process of being able to look to the past, utilizing our herbs and a lot of elder knowledge that's passed down. It may not even be passed down in book form, but it's just passed down orally. It might just be passed down regionally. It might be passed down within the family. But there are different traditions that help keep me centered. But also keeping focus, because I am, you know, I have PTSD, I have anxiety, I have depression as a result of the fact that I have to keep reminding myself that I'm in a war for the liberation and independence of my people and for their ability to be able to be self-determined and choose their own path, which we have never been given for 400 years in this country that has been stolen from our cousins, you know, and some of us, our brothers, our sisters, and our family. Keeping focused of the path that I came from, of the path that I am on, knowing that I am not alone, building community, taking time to myself, resting, eating as well as I possibly can, which means that I have to make sure that mutual aid is a thing that is and food is available. I come from historical food deserts, in housing projects with lead filled water and, you know, constant police brutality. So, growing up, I did not forget that. And I do not forget those who are still fighting imperialism in those settings. And so keeping myself grounded and focused, where I came from, where I am, and always keeping myself reminded that I'm not doing this just for, I'm doing this to get free. I'm doing this for independence. I'm doing this for autonomy. This is not, this isn't my hobby or just a passion project. I'm fighting for my actual life and the life of my babies and all of those around me who have been oppressed. And keeping myself grounded helps when things get really weird. And this past year has been really fucking weird. And I've had to keep coming back and center myself and remember who I am and remember why I do this. Because sometimes it gets a little hard when the tear gas and the bullets are flying, you know, reminding myself that imperialism was something imposed upon me and my people and that I will never fucking be satisfied until we are not under the jurisdiction of the United States Empire. And I will never be satisfied until everyone else is not a victim of the United States Empire, because there's no joy and there is no real liberation if it's just for oneself. So that's what keeps me centered and grounded when things get to be like a hurricane. So I thank you all for giving me the opportunity to speak tonight.
I just look at it's going down when I'm feeling down.
Word.
That's why I wanted to hear from Frank. No, I mean, seriously, it's like, I mean, Joan Baez has this quote, it's action is the antidote for despair. And even if it's not the actions I'm participating in or organizing, seeing what fucking brilliant, rabid, fierce claws out folks are doing across the fucking world to resist this terrorism, this nightmare, this dead future that we are living through. That's fucking an antidote. It's beautiful. and powerful, and I celebrate that. So, you know, I listen to, you know, CMS podcast. You know, there's a range of folks out there who are doing brilliant, amazing work, and that is part of, I think, what helps to fuel my fire. Because it's not about going, it's tending to a sacred fire. And I think that that's part of that spiritual affinity that Seema, I think, and I share, that we have different cultural contexts. I think we understand that on that level. And that fire is important to tend to whatever way that you can, that sacred fire within us. And so we do that with ceremony. We do that with medicine and a range of things. And I think it's also however you want to meditate or reflect on or answer the question of your purpose in these struggles and maintaining that on a spiritual, mental, and physical level as well in our approach to organizing, I think is key. It's a holistic challenge that we face if we're maintaining shit so we don't get burnt out, so we don't succumb to the despair. And it's also like, you know, embracing that despair sometimes, but in a way that recognizes the process of it. So I get fucking angry, but anger is a secondary emotion for me as a response to despair. And so I have a process for transforming that, and that usually is through cathartic actions, even if they're small fucking things, the smallest, you know, like counting of coups, if you will, the smallest strikes against this system. Some people do it through just like a fucking tagging or putting up a sticker, right? Just expressing that power in some way and asserting it against this fucking massive machinery, this onslaught of so-called civilization. So when it gets draining, when it gets hard, and I fucking take a break. Like I had a health issue recently, and one of my clan mothers, I guess, aunties, if you will, one of my clan relatives, said, fucking stop what you're doing. Take care of yourself. And it took me a lot because I was really in the midst of doing a lot of mutual aid work and, carried that burden as a response to grief, to help heal the issues we're facing in our community here. And, it was hard for me to do, but I listened. And so I had to humble myself and stop what I was fucking doing. And so sometimes that's important. Just recognize that you're not being a fucking activist and doing all that busy work. Sometimes you just need to fucking be grounded, like literally on the ground.
Thank you. Does anyone else have anything to add, to that before we move on to final comments?
Sure. I was just going to say thanks for setting this up. Happy May Day to everybody, and thanks to everybody else on the panel. And yeah, just going forward, I mean, I'm excited about the experiments, that people are going to be engaged in the coming terrain after everything that's happened and people building off of, just everything that's been going on lately. And it's going to be interesting to see where things go. And I think as long as we continue to talk to each other and continue to have these conversations and continue to organize and continue to question what we're doing. And I always like to think about it in terms of, you know, in what ways are we weak right now that we can try to overcome, how that we can, you know, get stronger and build our capacity and go forward. I think as long as we kind of keep that within our mindset, we're going to continue to grow.
Yeah, I want to say fuck the police. Fuck this state. Fuck this colonial state, this empire. Free all political prisoners, politicized prisoners, and people who shouldn't be in there, period, anyway. Free my comrade Kwame Shakur. Free my comrade Shaka Shakur. Free Ashley Diamond. Free up the resources. Free up the fucking land. Free the land. Free the land. Yeah. That's where I want to finish. And look out for the new EP from an outlaw to a maroon. It's the second part of Trap Liberation Army. I'm trying to be a superstar like Klee. A rock star.
I guess closing remarks. I wish you well for your picnic tomorrow.
Thank you.
I wish everyone well for the activities that they continue to engage in on many levels. As Sima said, this is war. I think we need to understand it on those terms and bring it back. Colonization has always been war against Mother Earth and all the beings, all life. You know, we're talking about the future. We're talking about intentions here. We have a lot of things that we've written about on indigenousaction.org. I invite folks to check that out, reflect. But I think as Frank has been encouraging everybody is to experiment. I think this is a really powerful time, powerful possibility for exciting experimentation and to see what works. There's a lot of directions we can go, but there's some really powerful, as I mentioned earlier, the precipice is here. And I think that the urge, the direction, and the tangibility of that is right before us. So I'm excited to see folks in the streets, out in nature and communities, in different spaces, trying to do what they can to bring this shit down, bring the system down. So in that spirit, I just want to thank you all and wish you well.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.